As an athlete, what is it that really drives you? In this episode, our guest helps you understand how motivation really works and how you can develop lasting motivation even when results don't quite go your way. This is the Thrive Podcast, the podcast that gives you the opportunity to, well, thrive. Welcome to another edition of the Thrive Podcast. Today we have another really, I'm excited about this guest, genuinely. He's a professor, author of several books, professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and founder of the research institution, the Center for Advanced Hindsight, I believe. It goes on and on and on. It really is an absolute pleasure to welcome the fantastic Dan Ariely. Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for allowing me to be here.
Dan, it's great to have you here. And I remember when I first got introduced to your work, I was extremely inspired by your story when you had that accident with the burns and you spent, I think it was several years in hospital. And I remember specifically how you mentioned the story, how the nurses would take off your bandage, like they would tear it off, and it was always very painful. And you asked them, like, why is it that you do it like this? And they were saying, it's the least painful way. And then over time, you discovered that actually it would be much less painful if they would do it slower and in different ways. And that got you really to think about irrational human behavior.
Exactly right.
Awesome. And having worked with a lot of athletes, you know, I feel there's so many people in the world of sports that have this like clear notion of what they think motivates players, what they think will make an athlete feel mentally good. Can you share, like, in what sense, like, irrational behavior could apply to athletes?
So first of all, I am not an athlete and certainly not a top athlete in any way. But let's kind of talk about two separate things. So let's take the example you started with, which is bandage removal. And what I learned in the process of doing experiments of hurting people in the lab with different ways and trying to understand how pain works is that it's not about the duration. You can take a bad experience and multiply it to double the duration, and you don't double the intensity. On the other hand, you take an experience and you make it worse in terms of intensity, even for a short time, and you make it much, much worse. Now, that thought is that basically duration doesn't matter as much and intensity matters much more for our memory of things. So I did a study on exercising. Now, these are not elite athletes. These are regular people. And in that study, we measured what gets people to remember an experience in a better way and therefore be more interested in repeating it. And it turns out that, for example, if you take a run and you make it twice as long, you don't make it twice as painful. You don't get people to feel worse about it. But if you change the amplitude of even 5 seconds within it, you change the memory of the whole thing. Now, if you think about it, the way we remember events is also what motivates us to engage in them later or not. And if the three of us were being in a room and we were trying to design exercises, we would say, how do we get people to exercise as hard as they can, but to remember that in a positive way? So, for example, it turns out that the last few minutes really matter. So how should you exercise? Should you exercise in a very harsh way and finish in, like, killing yourself to the end? Or should you end with something where you feel successful, victorious? It turns out the last moment really matter, and you want them to be actually positive. So in a very sad way, it turns out if you do colonoscopy, and the colonoscopy is an unpleasant process, but you do the same colonoscopy, but you leave the probe in for a few extra minutes, but you don't move it around, so you create less pain. People remember the colonoscopy in a better way, and therefore they're more likely to repeat it. So we could do, just taking your example from Burns and what got me started on this way, we could think about how would we design an exercise routine to create the best possible impression on people so that when they wake up the next day, they feel more energized to do it. Now, can you take something that is absolutely awful and make it absolutely delightful? No. But can you make it better in terms of our memory and therefore be more willing to look forward to it? The answer is yes. So that's one example. I'll give you another example. Maybe it's relevant, maybe not. I don't really understand athletes, professional athletes very, very well. But it turns out that if you look at exercises of normal people, you know what? I'll do something else. Let's think about motivation. What motivates people? Now people usually come up with very simple answers. We want money and fame and stuff like that. But it turns out that motivation is much more complex than that. People climb mountains. People run marathons. Now, just take climbing mountains. It's a crazy idea. You know, people die, they get injured. It's terrible. Nobody smiles on their way up the mountain. It's not as if it's a joyful experience. People suffer. It's pain. It's cold. They get frostbites. And when they finish this cold, painful, miserable experience, which they haven't smiled for a second during, it's not that they say, oh, this was the biggest mistake of my life. I'll never do it again. No, they want to do it again. We think about pursuing happiness. We ask people, what's your vision of happiness? People say, sitting on the beach drinking mojito. But the reality is none of us want a real life of sitting on the beach drinking mojito. It's good to have a day like this from time to time. But in fact, we're motivated by all kinds of crazy things. We're motivated by difficult things, challenges, complex things, things we feel improvement, working with others. Human motivation includes lots of things. If you look back at life and ask yourself, what are the things that we're proud of? Very few of them include, getting to inbox zero and sitting on the beach drinking mojito. Most of the things that we're proud of are complex and difficult and painful. They're things without smiles. But nevertheless, we're motivated for this. So if you ask me what is probably one of the best things for athletes to study, it would be the mysteries of human motivation. Because eventually the engine of athletes is motivation. Yes, it's also protein and so on, but it's really the engine is motivation. And what they need to do is to become experts on motivation. And it's motivation for peak performance, but it's also motivations for, the tough things of just getting out there and improving slowly, slowly.
It's an interesting topic, and it is definitely one thing that we wanted to talk to you about, Dan, because, of course, to be any type of high-performance athlete, motivation is a huge necessity. And, of course, that could be getting up in the morning to train, to practice, to put your body through all sorts of extremities. And I know from your book, which I've read, the one which is solely about motivation, I believe. I forget what it's called. You must forgive me.
Oh, it's fine. It's called Payoff.
Payoff, exactly, yes. But you outline a number of reasons to be motivated. So how can an athlete continue to be motivated regardless of results? Because at the end of the day, that's what motivates an athlete. They want those results.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, let's agree that this is an assumption that an athlete only want the results. There's lots of other things about it. For example, a sense of improvement. A sense of improvement is hugely motivating. And, you know, I talked to some concert pianists, and they're not endurance athletes, but, you know, they are certainly professionals. One discussion was with a guy, and he said that before a concert, he practices for about 150 days on the piece that he's going to do the concert for. And I talked to him and I said, you know, what keeps you going? Like, you know, can you imagine waking up every day and playing the same piece 150 days? And, you know, he starts being good. You know, it's not as if he starts by not knowing what he's going to do, but, you know, it's already quite good. And what he said is that it's about the nuances. Lots of pieces of the piece are easy and just goes through it. But he said there are a couple of places where he can measure improvement. We can measure a change. And when he told me that, it resonated. You know, I teach and I give lectures. And at some point, it's repetitive. And you can imagine it's, you know, I've given this lecture before. You know, how much fun can it be to do the same lecture again? So I met a friend who is an actor in the theater. And they do the same things over and over. And I said, what do you do? And he said that he keeps on making small changes. He keeps on making small changes and testing whether these are improving things or not. So he said, for example, he changes the pauses that he creates. Now, right now, I paused for a long time. I felt uncomfortable. Like from, you know, I paused for a long time after I finished this. It felt too long to me. But, you know, looking at your smile, it was actually quite effective. But that's what Daniel, this actor, told me he was doing. He said he has the basic layer of acting, and he has a second layer in which he tries to think about his acting and try small things. And importantly, he notes whether they made an improvement or not. And he said that this is, for him, was the sense of improvement. And it was the same thing for the concert pianist. And I started using the same thing in lectures. I tried different versions of joke. I tried to pause. I tried to explain things differently. They're not massive improvements, but it's the feeling of mastery. So yes, I think people love good results and everybody would enjoy winning and so on. But I think there is something that is crucially important, is the feeling of improvement and the feeling of mastery and the feeling that you know what it is that you're doing. So, you know, if athletes can do what Daniel the actor was doing, which is to exercise at two different levels, the basic level in which they are at their performance, and then the second layer in which they try slight different variations and check for themselves, is this making it better or worse, and noting the change, I think that's a fantastic source of motivation.
Just following on from that, Dan, and it's really, really fascinating. I know that the legendary boxer Marvin Hagler once said, it's very hard to get up, I think, at 4 a.m. to go for your run in silk pyjamas. But of course, when one reads your book, you realise there are more things to be motivated for than those silk pyjamas. But you talk about the notion of the present and the future when it comes to motivation and discipline. I know that I'm a big fan of quotes. There's a famous quote that discipline is the difference between what you want now and what you want, which is effectively what you allude to in your book. But you say it's harder to be motivated for something in the future. Now, if an athlete or a tennis player or a boxer wants to win the world championship, they need to be motivated by that thing in the future, particularly if you're on the lowest rung of the ladder. So looking at that at that theory, how does that work for an athlete? That theory of the future and what we want now.
Yeah. So first of all, I think we need to recognize that being motivated about the future is just not going to happen. I'm not saying we'll have zero effect, but that's just no way to get people to be motivated. And, you know, you just need to look at human nature, right? Global warming, you're in London right now, sweating. You know, but if you think about global warming is obviously an example, but if you think about people overeating, not sleeping enough, not exercising, not taking our medication, having unprotected sex, not washing our hands when we leave the bathroom. I mean, the list is endless of the things we know we should be doing and we don't do. And all of them, actually, this is one of the main human ailments, is that we are really good in wanting something now and really not so good in wanting something in the future. And kind of a standard example in behavioral economics is, you come to people and you say, hey, I have an option here for you. What would you like? A half a box of chocolate right now or a full box of chocolate in a week? Half now or full in a week? And you open the box of chocolate and you let them smell it and look at it. And it's this amazing Belgian truffles. And the vast majority of people say, give me the half a box of chocolate now. Not worthwhile for me to wait a week for another half a box of chocolate. And then to another group, you change the choice a little bit. And you say, what would you rather have? A half a box of chocolate in a year or a full box of chocolate in a year in a week? Now, it's the same choice. Do you get a half a box of chocolate a week earlier or a full box of chocolate a week later? But when it's phrased like that, everybody says, oh, waiting another week, no problem. Now, why is that? It's because the moment the box of chocolate is here and we can smell it and we can feel it, our emotion gets ignited and we lose our patience. Waiting a week feels too much. When the chocolate is in the future, a year from now, a year and a week, who cares? It's in the future. We don't see it. We don't smell it. We don't get emotional about it. And now you say, oh, cognitively, of course, it's, who would not wait another week for another half a box of chocolate? So in the present, we're emotional and we are myopic and we want immediate gratification. In the future, we're cognitive. We do the right thing. And you know, we fail in this all the time, right? It's why we text and drive and all the things that we've captured. Now, what can we do about it? Now, you could say, oh, let's tell people that this is not a good idea. Maybe they'll change their ways. Of course, that's not true, right? It's not as if I would tell you now, hey, by the way, did you know texting and driving is unhealthy? Please stop. I say, oh, thank you very much. I didn't know it was dangerous. I'll stop immediately or, you know, anything like that. So what do we do? There's a couple of mechanisms that help us connect our future self to our short-term self. And maybe the best known one is what is called Ulysses contracts. If you remember the story from the Odyssey, Ulysses knew that if the sirens will sing, he will divert the boat and crash himself and everybody else on the shores, on the rocks. So what did he do? He asked the sailors to tie him to the mast. And this way, he couldn't act on his wishes. He could hear the song of the sirens, but he couldn't take an action. He was tied down. And he asked the sailors to put wax in their ears. So this way the sailors were unaware that the sirens were singing at all. And this is how they sailed through. He enjoyed the singing without taking an action, and the sailors did not hear anything. And these are kind of two important methods for overrunning temptation. The sailors, you're just unaware that the temptation exists, right? Don't go to the bakery. And Ulysses himself created a mechanism that he couldn't act on it. So think about if you put your phone in the trunk of the car, you hear that it's ringing, but you can't take an action. Right? What the sailors did was to turn off the phone, so they were unaware that somebody was looking for them. So that's one type of mechanism, and it's a tying your hands. It's basically promising and making the situation such that the future self can't behave badly. An example, you go to a training camp that doesn't have any unhealthy food. You're going to get stuck, or you get somebody to drop you in the middle of the desert and you have to find your way back. There's no other way, but you have to run back. So there are mechanisms like that when we force our future self. Now, you can do things that are slightly lighter. For example, you can hire a personal trainer. And if you prepay them and they don't give you your money back, then you wake up on Monday. You don't feel like going, but you're ready. Promised, you paid, they're waiting for you, and you'll go. So these are Ulysses contracts. These are mechanisms that require that we know that our future self will misbehave. So we put our future self in a situation that they would have a hard time misbehaving. Right? And you can think about automated retirement savings, and you can think about you go to a restaurant that only serves healthy food. You can say, let me buy cheesecake. And I'll eat a really small piece every day. Or you can say, no, I'm not going to be able to do it, so let me just not buy cheesecake from the beginning, right? And then you're stuck at home with the food that you have. I teach at Duke, and at Duke for a long time, we had the rice diet. People would pay a lot of money to Duke to come and be locked in a room with rice. Now, you can eat rice at home, much, much cheaper, but the locking in is actually very important. Okay, that's one kind of mechanism. Another kind of mechanism is what we call reward substitution. Reward substitution. And my example for this is when I was in hospital, one of the things that I got was hepatitis C. I got a blood transfusion with hepatitis C. At the time, I didn't know it was hepatitis C. I just knew it was hepatitis, and it was, it was tough to be injured and get hepatitis. Delayed treatments, skin was rejected, all kinds of bad things happened. Fast forward 7 years. I'm in grad school, more than 7 years, 8 years. I'm already in grad school, and I have another flare-up. I have a flare-up. I checked myself into hospital. By that time, they told me it was hepatitis C. And there was a new treatment of a combination of a medication called interferon and ribavirin that was going to be helpful, maybe helpful for hepatitis C. And they asked me if I want to join the treatment. It was an FDA-approved trial. And I said, what happened if I don't? And they described to me what it feels like to die from liver cirrhosis, which, by the way, is not a good way to go. So I joined the trial, and the trial was very unpleasant. Interferon was a medication that was originally approved for hairy cell leukemia, a terrible illness, lots of side effects. Vomiting, shaking, stuff like that, headaches. Anyway, I would come home from the university, I would open the fridge, I had these vials and injections, and every time I took an injection, I got sick. Vomiting, headache, shakes, fevers, basically for the whole night. Fast forward a year and a half. I took this medication 3 times a week for a year and a half. Fast forward a year and a half, I have a biopsy. I beat the disease. By the way, now they have a much better medication for Hep C, but at that time, that was the best medication. And my doctor, Dr. Killenberg, told me I was the only patient in the protocol who took their medication on time. The question is, why? Do I like my liver more than other people like their livers? Am I more rational? And the answer, of course, is no to all of those. The answer is that I changed my environment. I created reward substitution. And my particular weakness is that I love movies. If I had time, I would watch lots of movies. I don't have much time. I don't watch that many movies. But on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, which were injection day, I would go to the video store first thing in the morning. These were days when there were video stores. I would rent 2 videos I really wanted to watch. I would carry them in my backpack the whole day. I would come home at night, put the video in, inject myself, and start watching the film. I didn't wait for the side effects to start. It would take them about an hour. I connected the thing I did not want, the injection, with the thing I wanted, the videos. By the way, my whole apartment, my student apartment, was set up for that. My bed was in front of the TV. I had the bucket, I had the blanket. I was all ready for all the side effects. And that together with the fact that, you know, when you watch movies like this, you don't remember them. So I could watch the same movie over over and over. But anyway, that kept me going for about a year and a half. But what is the point? The point is that livers are really important. Movies are not that important. And it wasn't as if I said, oh, I really want movies. I don't care about livers. No, but the effect of the liver was going to happen in 30 years, maybe. If I took the medication 3 times a week for a year and a half, maybe I would not have a liver cirrhosis 30 years down the line. But for sure, I'll have a miserable night tonight. I did not try to train myself to think about the future, to love my liver, and so on. I basically found a reward substitution. I said, let me act now in the way that gives me something now. So that's the second mechanism. It's a different mechanism than the first one, right? The first one was, let me force my future self to behave in a certain way. This one is to say, let me reward my present self in a way that it's not about winning the Olympics. It's too long term. It's about something now. Now, you don't want to reward yourself with a cookie. There's a study that when people wear some of these watches and go on a diet, they actually lose less weight than if they don't wear these watches. And why? Because when they reach 10,000 steps, they celebrate, often with a cookie. And there's a beautiful paper called "You Can't Outrun a Bad Diet." Like, if you eat cookies, like, you know, weight is going to increase. There's no way around it. So people basically rewarded themselves too much with unhealthy food. So the second mechanism is a mechanism that thinking about our nature and the fact that we like immediate reward, and thinking about how do we design the environment to give us immediate rewards. Now, it doesn't have to be a cookie or ice cream. It could be feeling good, a pat on the shoulder, a kind word. It can be all kinds of things. Be watching something on TV, or treating yourself to... I, by the way, use espressos as a motivation. So there's lots of things that we can do. We need to find ourselves about what is a short-term motivation for good behavior. And then another mechanism that I think is very important is the mechanism of rituals. Now, a lot of people think about habits. And habits is this idea that you learn not to pay attention to. So, you know, when we learned how to drive, it was really tough. And you couldn't change the station and the radio and drive at the same time. And, you know, if you had to change gears, you had to really focus on that. And now we drive and I ask you, you know, which lights were green and red, you have no idea. Right? And what happened is that the brain is really good in taking a task that is repetitive and learning how not to pay attention to it. Attention is really precious for the brain. So if there are things that we do repeatedly, we take them away. And by the way, for professional athletes, you probably know this much better than I do, if you're a tennis player, it's really good for you to play naturally and not to start overthinking your shot. Because if you overthink, the nature is so good in doing things without attention. And then when you bring thoughts into it, you actually slow yourself down. So there's lots of things that if we do repeatedly, nature basically says, okay, I understand this. Stop paying attention to this. We'll just make it natural. We'll make it natural for you. Stop paying attention to it. And when you try to pay attention, we do it worse. So we understand habits, we understand habitual behavior, we understand attention, but rituals are not about habits. ritual is the third mechanism, I think, which is important, is to say rituals are mechanisms that actually get their power from extra attention. Think about rituals, washing your hands in a ritualistic way. I mean, mostly it's religious, but you know, you wash your hand in a religious way. You stand up in a certain way. People do the cross, whatever you do, you count the beads in Islam. Whatever you do, it's not about paying less attention. It's about paying more attention. It's about, in fact, getting into the experience. One non-religious example is wine. I don't know if you like wine, but wine has a crazy amount of rituals. In fact, we have a whole language for wine. Tannin, complexity, acidity, look at the leg of this thing. We buy special glasses for this. We look at the light. We swirl the thing. We don't do this with milk. Now, in principle, you can imagine a single cow milk. You can imagine the waiter is coming to your table and say, hey, there's Betsy. She's the cow that is giving you your milk today. Let me tell you a little bit about Betsy. She grew up in a farm. Then she moved here. She has a history of, you know. We don't do it with milk. But with wine, we get crazy into the details. And some of it is like a placebo effect, but some of it is actually changing the way we consume wine. We stop, we pause, we pay attention, we think about it, and in the process, we get much more enjoyment from it. You know, if you sat in front of your laptop and drank a glass of wine from a jug and did not pay attention to it, you wouldn't enjoy it. The ritual, the language, and so on directs attention. The moment you call something a leg of wine, you look at the wine differently. You call something tannins, you look for a taste differently. You talk about acidity. Oh, let's think about this. So rituals are really mechanisms to draw more attention and direct attention. And there are mechanisms that can make things much more pleasurable, like in the example of wine. So if you think about, there's some beautiful studies by Mike Norton and his colleagues, where they took carrots and they got people to tap on the table. They tap twice on the table and then clap twice. And then you eat a carrot and then you eat again. And guess what? People enjoy carrots more. I did a study in which we ritualized tying shoelaces. We asked people when they tie their shoelaces before they go for a run to say something. With this, I take care of my body and soul. Yeah, some kind of, you know, new age made up stuff. But on average, we increased the number of people went for a run by one time per week. Why? Because people enjoy putting their shoes on more. And once you put your shoes on, there's a good chance you'll go running. So the first mechanism is about forcing your future self to be act better. The second mechanism is about creating some short-term rewards. And the third mechanism is about expanding the attention and meaning we give things. And then thereby making them more salient, important, useful, and so on. And the extreme, of course, is when something becomes your identity. You know, if you wake up every day and you say to yourself, should I recycle today or not? And you say, every time I recycle, it saves City Hall 25 cents. But every day you do the cost-benefit analysis. Yeah, but it's raining, it's cold, it's hot, it's this. There'll be many days that you'll do the cost-benefit analysis and you'll decide not to recycle. But if you stop thinking about it in the cost-benefit analysis and you say to yourself, good people recycle, and I'm good people. Now you're not doing the cost-benefit analysis every time. It's your identity, right? You elevated recycling from the action itself to a higher order meaning. And rituals, of course, help do that. And now you're much more likely to do it. So that's another approach, is if you think about rituals and high order meanings That's another very important mechanism to get things to be more desirable. I feel I'm talking nonstop and not letting you participate.
No worries. It's very, very interesting. And I think that brings me to an interesting topic, Dan, that you talk a lot about in Payoffs. And it's the topic of money, fame, status. And when I look at athletes and look what makes them feel unhappy, and probably that's not the reason, but they often think it's either when they're like a struggling artist and they say, you know, once I earn X amount of money, or once I reach this ranking, or I become famous, I'll feel good and be happy. And then the second category is athletes who actually make it. They become really famous, really successful. They make a lot of money and suddenly they struggle, like they're still not happy. So can you give us some insight why money, status, fame aren't great motivational factors, and what is more motivational?
Yeah, so first of all, we have to admit and recognize that part of our happiness is just genetic. And it's kind of happy and sad to recognize it, but it just say, you know, wherever you go, you take yourself with you. And I have a joke about my ex-wife, but I'll.
Although we're very open for jokes, it doesn't have to.
I'll restrain myself. Podcast. No, it's not a nice joke. But anyway, if you're an unhappy person, you're going to be unhappy. You know, it's going to be very hard to change. It's not that you can't change anything, but about 50% of what we think of well-being is you. It's the person. Okay, so that's one element. The other element is what is called the hedonic treadmill. And the hedonic treadmill is this idea that we look forward and we think, oh, if this only changed, I will be really happy. So let's use money as an example, but I think that ranking in athletes are the same. So you say to yourself, if I only had a new carpet, I would be so happy. So you get a new carpet and you get happy for a while, but a month later you're used to that carpet. And you say, you know, you get adapted. You used to get used to it. It's not new anymore. It's there every day. Take it for granted. So you say to yourself, I'm not happy. Last time I bought the carpet, I became happier. Let me buy a new car. So you buy a new car and you're happy for a couple of months, and then the happiness goes down again to do its level. And the idea is that we keep on... we're remembering that when we bought something, we became happier, which is true, but it's the change that makes us happy, and the steady state is not making us as happy. So we keep on pursuing things that don't make us happy in the long term. They do make us happy in the short term. By the way, experiences from that perspective are better than things, because a thing, like a carpet, you get used to. An experience changes you as a person and stays with you in a very different way. So you're going to climb Mount Everest. You know, after that, you're going to be a different person, or, you know, let's do something less dangerous. You're going to, you know, hike the Israel Trail for a month. You know, at the end of this month, you'll be a different person that stays with you in a very different way. So the hedonic treadmill is we always look forward and we say, if we only did this, we would be happy. But then when you get there, things change. And we talked about adaptation as one mechanism. You get used to things. But there's another mechanism, which is you surround yourself with different people. So imagine that I compete at the level of my school. So if I only got to be the best athlete, I would be really happy. So you become the best athlete. But then you move to compete at the city level. And now you're not at the top anymore. So you become less happy. So if I only be at the best, I will be. And then you keep on moving in the same way that people who become wealthier move to more expensive neighborhoods. And then they feel less wealthy compared to the people around them. So those are a couple of the mechanism of we don't predict correctly our adaptation. We think we'll be happy for longer. By the way, this is also happening on the bad side. I describe it as only on the good side. Oh, good things happen to us, but we adapt. It's also on the bad things. So if I think about my injury, you know, I was injured quite badly. If you ask me at age 17, before I got injured, how happy would you be in your life if you got burned in 70% of your body and spend the next 3 years in hospital? I would say, oh, this would be terrible. Actually, I'm 55 now. If you ask me when I was 20, how happy would you be when you're 55? Who can imagine being this old? Probably want to die. You know, the reality is that we get used to things. You get used to good things and we get used to bad things. You get used to, in my case, scars, burns, limitations, pain. There's lots of things that we get used to. It's good and bad. It's kind of a blessing and a curse. On the good side, bad things happen to us and we adjust to them quite quicker than we thought to. You experience a romantic heartbreak, and when you experience it, you say, oh, I'll be miserable for life. And 3 months later, you're in a very different situation. You say, I couldn't have predicted that I will be over this, but you are. So it happens on the good side and on the bad side. And the second mechanism is that we sometimes move, as we are more successful, we move from group to group. And therefore, we don't enjoy feeling at the top or feeling successful for as long. So those are some of the mechanism that get us not to be as happy. Now, in terms of money, there's a lot of evidence that professional athletes in the U.S. Make a lot of money when they become professionals, and then they get used to a very, very lavish lifestyle, and they basically get bankrupt very quickly. Within 5 years, many of the professional athletes are bankrupt. And you know, I'm not blaming them. It's just that it's really hard. Now, at some point, I met this amazing baseball player. I will not tell you his name, but he was an amazing baseball player, one of the legends. Where at the conference, I gave a talk about the psychology of money and saving and what's, you know, making us how to save and so on. And he told me the following story. He said he was a college player and he moved to the pros and he had an agent. And they have their first paycheck. And they go on the field and the coach is handing them each an envelope with a check. And he opens the envelope and it says $2,000. And he knows he signed the contract for millions. Like, why is this $2,000? So he called his coach, kind of his manager, kind of, what's going on? And his manager said, look, I'm giving you spending money. I'm handling everything else. If you want to spend more, let's talk about it. But I'm handling everything. And now he when we talked, it was a few years ago, he retired. He was incredibly wealthy. They had the foundation, all kinds of things like that. But he said it was because his manager didn't give him the freedom to make the mistakes he would have done. And he said he looks at his friends and his friends lived very high, but are very broke now. So when it comes to our decision-making, you know, we often think that we are the best people to decide about, you know, what's good for us and what's not. The reality is it's very hard to make good decisions. And it's sometimes good to give somebody external, impartial, unemotional, what decisions to make for us. In the same way, if you want to eat healthy, go to a restaurant and ask your buddy to order for you. You know, you'll not get fries and you'll not get cake this way, right? Your buddy they don't get the joy of the food. They just get, they want you to be healthy, so they'll order. Sometimes it's good to have an impartial person who is not influenced by emotion. And this baseball player got his coach, his manager to be that for him. And many times what we need to do is we need to realize our shortcoming in decisions and give the permission to make decisions for us to other people.
Dan, listen, you're obviously very generous with your time. We're very grateful. I could ask you a whole bunch of other questions. Just one other thing, because I think pain has obviously been something that's been very prevalent in your life and has been, as Henry Ford, I think, said, that pain is the yeast that allows you to rise up. Something like that. I don't know quite what his metaphor was, but pain is obviously, to some athletes, a form of motivation, or certainly they feel they have to overcome the pain to get to that. I look at recently in tennis in the French Open where Rafa Nadal was in pain every day and managed to win his 14th title. Can you just explain how some people are willing to suffer and struggle and seem to thrive when facing obstacles? How is that? And others, is it down to just different people's contexts of motivation?
Yeah, so I don't think it's different people. I think it's different pain. So if you think about the pain I had, it was a lot, but it was generally the good kind of pain. And what do I mean by the good kind of pain? It was the pain that signal improvements. I had pain in bandage removal. I had pain in physiotherapy. I had pain in surgery. Most pain signaled something is getting better. It wasn't cancer pain that says pain means death is closer. It was pain that means something is getting better. And I think for athletes, And I talked to a very impressive athlete called Joe Pep, a cyclist that used to cycle for the U.S. Olympic team. And he described to me the pain that cyclists experience, which is incredible to hear their story. But he talked about that he was trying to get the interpretation of the pain to be positive, because pain is a signal, right? Pain is nature telling you, don't touch this oven or don't do that. And because of that, pain has a negative feeling, an effect on us, because it says, don't. Now, we can't completely override pain without serious narcotics, but what we can do is give it a different interpretation. And the moment you give it an interpretation of saying, my body is getting better, I'm achieving, I'm successful, all this is improving. By the way, there's another beautiful, beautiful piece of paper, beautiful research. Imagine that you come to a room and there are two people, you and another person, and the other person actually works for the experiment. You don't know it. And they say, hey, one person will choose the punishment, the other person will get the punishment. And they flip a coin and you're going to get the punishment and the other people get to choose the punishment. And the punishment is either very mild or it's a set of electrical shocks. Now, you came, you're going to be the one getting the punishment, the other one goes to the room, you go to a room, and then they tell you the other person chose the heavier electrical shocks for you. Okay. Now, at one time, they tell you they chose it, but in the other time, they say they actually chose the boring punishment for you, but they didn't know it, and the buttons on the computer were wired the wrong way. So you're getting the bad punishment, but they chose the light punishment for you. Right? So in both cases, you're in the room, you're going to get big emotional shocks, but in one case, you think that the other person chose it for you. There's intention, bad intention. In the other case, they had good intention, it just didn't work out. And it turns out that when the intention was good, people feel less pain. So pain, you know, what Joe Pep in kind of in general, you would say pain is a signal, but there's a lot of room for interpretation. You can interpret it as my body's dying, or you can say my muscles are being built. You can say this is an awful coach doing it to me, or you can say this is somebody who has my best intention and well-being at heart. So it's a signal. And, you know, in the same, it's true for lots of sensory things, but there's a lot of room for interpretation. So if you ask me, are there people who suffer pain more or less? Of course. But I think that the biggest factor is how we interpret. What is our interpretation of the pain? And to the extent that we can interpret pain in a healthier way, we would be healthier.
So it's about the framing is what you're saying. It's the way you frame it. A half glass full or a half glass empty type of thing with regard to pain. Yep. Listen, Dan, I can only say I got so many things that I could ask you, but obviously we can't. It's fascinating just listening to you, reading your stuff. I don't know if Alan's got anything to add before we let you go.
I think just as a final question, since this show is really about mental well-being, if there's one advice you could give athletes, and I know it's not your main target audience, but you seem to have a deep understanding of what athletes go through. If you would have one advice to athletes, what they can do to preserve their mental well-being, what would it be?
So I'm not sure this is advice for athletes or it's more general. There's something in child psychology called secure attachment. And let's say you have a kid, 4 years old, you take them to the playground, they say, hey, kid, go and play. There's a swing, go to the swing. If the kid goes to the swing and comes back 20 minutes later, you have a kid with secure attachment. If the kid goes, but every minute and a half they look behind their shoulder to see if you're still there, you don't have a kid with secure attachment. And secure attachment is really resilience. It's really this idea that we have a social insurance policy, that if something bad will happen, somebody will be there to catch you. And in general, if you think, just imagine two ways of walking around the world. One is walking around the world knowing that if something happens, somebody will catch you. What are you willing to do? What chances are you willing to take? What are you willing to explore? On the other hand, if you think that every mistake, you're doomed, you know, where are you in terms of your ability? So I think that creating a sense of secure attachment, investing in resilience, friendships, and so on, it's kind of the best insurance policy we have, right? We insure our cars and our homes and so on. But what we really want to insure is we want the feeling that we are invincible. And the way we're invincible is that it's that if something bad will happen, we will still be fine. How do we invest in that? And, you know, if I think about kind of professional athletes, I think about people who are in a competitive environment, often alone, not a lot of time for social experiences. It's probably tempting to not invest a lot in that realm, but I think that investing in that feeling of resilience and secure attachment is incredibly important. And maybe I'm saying this because, you know, we're just after COVID and we had such a long period of being alone and so on. But I think it's not just COVID. I think it's more general.
Just one quick question. How do people learn more about you and learn about all your fantastic work and talks, etc.?
So I have a website, Dan Ariely, www.danariely.com. And, you know, maybe the three of us at some point will do some studies together. Maybe we'll explore the psychology of athletes. Maybe we'll do something.
Do head over to the Thrive website. That's www.thrive,
spelt THR, the digit one, VE dot space, where you can sign up for further giveaways and, of course, tips. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, one, VE dot space. After all, this is your space to thrive.